You're now listening to Minorities in Business with Edwin Serrano.
Yo, this is Sum Total. You are now listening to Minorities in Business with Edwin Serrano.
What's going on, everybody? You are now listening to Minorities in Business. This is a show dedicated to shedding a light on today's top entrepreneurs, creatives, and industry leaders within the minority community as they share tips and resources to help sustain and grow minority businesses. I have the pleasure of speaking to today's special guest, Natalie Safat. Natalie is a 10-plus year social media expert who has consulted for some of the most iconic brands in the world, including Samsung, Facebook, WeWork, and LinkedIn, curating original social media content, strategy, and campaigns. Natalie gains millions of impressions for the brand she advocates for when she's not with her clients. Natalie loves sharing her social media thought leadership in her Forbes column on television and at conferences and universities, including the Today Show, NPR, South by Southwest, and more. Natalie is with us today to share some of her story. So what's up, Natalie? Thanks for joining us and welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Edwin. It's great to be here.
So I did give you the intro, but how do you introduce yourself when you're meeting people these days?
Ah, you did give me a really good intro. Mine usually doesn't get to be that long. Otherwise, I think I would lose people. I like to say that I'm a social media creative. I love to tell stories and share my experiences and hopefully help people use social media to mobilize an audience and make themselves invaluable in business. Mm.
Let's start with a quick this or that to get to know you. Phone call or text?
Ooh, I'm like a phone call person.
Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Cardio or weights?
Neither.
Beer or wine?
Wine.
Horror or comedy?
Comedy.
iPhone or Android?
Ooh, Android.
Ooh.
Samsung girl. You knew that. That was in the intro. I'm very loyal to my Samsung.
Football or basketball?
Ooh. My husband would kill me, so I'm going to say football for him.
Netflix or YouTube?
Netflix.
Mountains or ocean?
Ocean. We got to keep Florida represented here.
There you go. So for those that don't know you, let's start from the beginning. Where were you born and how was your upbringing?
So I'm from a town called Coral Springs, which is about 3 hours south of you, Edwin, in South Florida.
Right.
I don't know if you've been to Coral Springs. It's a pretty small town in the sense that, you know, you could kind of put it anywhere in the country and it
right.
would kind of look like something else. It's got, you know, there's a movie theater. There's, you know, a bunch of restaurants. There's a shopping mall. You know, we've got a bunch of Dunkin' Donuts and dollar stores, and you know, it's a suburban town that
right.
is about an hour outside of Miami, so very much a Fort Lauderdale or Miami suburb.
Right.
You know, I grew up in a sort of middle class environment with, you know, parents that worked really, really hard, a mother specifically who you know, would sometimes come home after my sister and I were already asleep and put in kind of her 12 or 15 hours that day working at a gas station that my parents owned. So, you know, very much a hardworking community that I lived in and family that I got to, you know, watch and kind of later emulate now that I have my own small business.
You went to UCF and received a BA in journalism. You graduated, I'm assuming, from Coral Springs.
I graduated from you're exactly right. I went to high school at Carabella High School in Coral Springs. And then I went to UCF and graduated in 06 with a journalism degree. Exactly right.
And what were the advantages of being taught traditionally, whereas some are self-taught nowadays?
What do you mean? Sorry, Edwin.
So you went to school for journalism. The things you learned at UCF, is that translating to the real world, or did you learn most of the things out in the real world?
That question makes perfect sense. Sorry, I just didn't understand you. I think the thing I look back at UCF and feel the most strongly is that I just had terrific educators, and specifically one educator. His name is Rick Brunson. He is the journalism adjunct professor at UCF for at least 15 years. He still teaches there, and he also is a contributing editor to the Orlando Sentinel. He was so just committed to not only my success, but the success of every student in his journalism class. And that included helping us find internships, helping me get the job of entertainment editor at the school paper, which used to be called the Central Florida Future, which actually earned me a scholarship in my senior year. Rick Brunson was just an immense force of compassion and leadership. And actually, the coolest thing ever was a year ago, you know, nearly 12 years after graduating, UCF invited me back, and I got to speak on a panel with my journalism professor, Rick Brunson. Two of us spoke with, a group of journalism students, you know, an event of maybe 100 people, and the students got to sort of hear from Rick and I about, you know, how it sort of, how UCF shaped me, my journalism education there, and then now how I translated to this social media world that 13 years ago when I was in college didn't exist.
Right. And talking about, you know, transitioning from UCF, so you went to New York right away, right after you graduated?
I did. I moved to New York a couple weeks after graduation.
And you had a decent paying job. What were one of the factors or that you were struggling with before taking the leap of faith of starting your own business? So you were already, you know, working in your high paying job. What were some things that were holding you back in your in that position?
Well, started out, you know, right after college, I took my first ever internship at Rolling Stone magazine, and a few months later they hired me to be an editorial assistant. So I was writing for Rolling Stone magazine and rollingstone.com. And I was there for about 2 years when I got laid off. And I remember sort of thinking in that moment, you know, Natalie, you could go to Billboard or Spin or, you know, any other publication, and you'd probably get a job, you know, pretty quickly. You know, I might be making the same amount of money, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. But what kind of scared me is this idea that, you know, print journalism was evolving so fast. And I didn't want to necessarily be a part of that machine of you know, every year or two having to find a new job, worrying about layoffs, worrying about, you know, the budget for a print publication getting, you know, demolished, which of course is the case for the last 10 years at most print publications. And so I started to kind of think to myself, look, like any good entrepreneur, you know, where is the demand and how can I create a supply? So at the time, sort of social media, you know, was very much an option, not the priority that it is today for so many companies. And so I started to think about, okay, there's a lot of companies that I've interacted with at my time at Rolling Stone. A few of them have already approached me saying, hey, would you write a guest blog post for us? Would you interview this band for our, you know, video series on Facebook? Early days social media. And so I started to really think, okay, how can I take these offers and these opportunities and turn them into a business? And so, you know, within a few months, I was able to, you know, sign deals with companies like Showtime Networks and Levi's and Adidas. And I remember thinking, okay, there's something there. And I realized also pretty quickly, look, you know, I'm making 2-3 times what I was making at my full-time job. It would have almost been harder to stay in a full-time role when I knew sort of the potential that was possible doing my own thing, starting my own business.
See, I agree completely. But you went to school for journalism. So does the fact that your family had their own business, you already had your eye open to that side of the supply and demand? Because a typical journalism student or someone who's not so entrepreneurial would just stay the course of, all right, I guess I got to get another job. So was the fact that your family had their own business and you saw that growing up, did that play a factor in you seeing those things?
Absolutely. Very intuitive of you that, my family, both parents being entrepreneurs, absolutely, you know, has sort of shaped this idea that I, you know, I want to be able to work and also play. I want to be able to one day when I'm a parent, you know, sort of never miss a piano recital, which is what I always say about my parents, who worked so hard but also were able to be there for us because, of course, they had, you know, control of their schedules and their own businesses. That very much inspired me. And also, I think, you know, that sort of entrepreneurial spirit that I got, just realizing that social media was such a in-demand service that people were really knocking on my door for. You know, it was kind of unusual. People, you know, now struggle to understand this, but at the time, there weren't a lot of social media professionals. You know, there weren't a lot of people who you could hire to run your social channels with confidence. And, you know, you kind of didn't know who to go to. So if I did a really good job for Adidas, this is a real life example, they introduced me to my next client, which was Food Network. You know, because those two social media people like knew each other, and with that small of a community, that they, if they had a good reference, you know, they wanted to make it and help each other. So it was almost like I was being presented with this almost like unavoidable opportunity to become a small business owner, and serve all of these great brands, and then just kind of figure out from there, which, you know, to your point, I was a journalism student. I didn't know how to run a business.
Right.
I didn't know what to charge or, you know, how to create a contract that would be fair to, you know, American Express if, for example, MasterCard approached me. You know, I didn't know any of these things. And you know, it took me a little while to figure them out.
And I heard you talk about the meeting you had with the boss you had at the time. Explain what that meeting entailed that gave you your first client and the confidence to start your own business.
Yeah. So, I was consulting. I was working for a fashion company, and, they're a pretty high end luxury fashion brand. And I was doing their social media, and I was running an online magazine for them, and they were having me come in 5 days a week. I mean, it was like a full-time job. And I remember saying to them, listen, after about a year and a half, you know, I walked into the owner of the company's office, and he and I, you know, were very close in contact. So we had monthly check-ins, and I remember sitting in front of him and saying, you know, I'm actually being overpaid. And remember, I'm a writer at a fashion company. So like that would almost be impossible, right? I bet that was the first time he ever heard that phrase. I told him, I said, I'm being paid for, you know, work that I'm not necessarily, you know, in sort of the need to be a part of. As an example, I'm sitting in meetings that really largely don't have to do with anything I have going on. Sitting in meetings where the last 5 minutes are reserved for social media. Again, this is like now in 2011,
right,
way before social media was what it is today. And I was spending a lot of time working on, you know, sitting in a meeting with the website designer. Again, things that had nothing to do with social.
Right.
And so I told him, listen, if you're willing to cut my salary in half, let me come in 2 days a week instead of five, and I won't work with any of your competitors, so any other high-end fashion brands. I think we should sign a contract for a one-year deal, as effective next month. And so he went home, and he thought about it, and I thought about it, and kind of was, like, unsure where he would decide. But by the time I got home, I had an email waiting for me saying, let's do this. And so that was my first client. It was my existing employer.
Wow.
Transitioning from full-time to being a client of mine. And I think it's really part of what gave me the confidence to start my business and really sign on all of these great brands and say to myself, listen, you know, if you're giving me this opportunity and this guaranteed income, if I can find one or two others who will do the same, I'm going to be significantly outperforming what my salary is here.
And what are some of the things, because like you said earlier, you were a journalism student. So what were some things you struggled with early that you had to learn as you adapted to becoming an entrepreneur?
Oh, man, so many, Edwin. You know, I had to start thinking about contracts for the first time ever. I had to start thinking about what to charge someone. I started asking myself, too, like, in the marketing world, what are campaigns that have never been done before? You know, if something has been done, how can we reimagine it? But doing a ton of research just to figure out, like, what are things that people have you know, what are successful campaigns that people have completed that have done really well? And then, you know, it got into some interesting sort of I don't know, wild, wild west territory almost, right? It got into a situation where I was being asked to work with a brand, and their competitor approached me and said, we also want to work with you. Mm. And I actually said, yes, I worked with both brands. And then what happened is that the first brand got very upset. They said, you can't work with our competitor. You've now endorsed our product. You've been posting about it on your social media channels. You've been blogging about it. And I had to realize very quickly that if a company didn't want me to work with their competitors, what I had to build into a contract was a exclusivity clause.
Right.
That if I only work with Lyft, let's say, then I can't work with Uber or Via or Juno or any other rideshare company. This
right.
is just an example.
Right.
Lyft has to then buy out the category. So they have to make it worth my while that I can say no with confidence to any of their competitors. And so that is something that we build into our contracts now for years, that if you want me to not post about your competitor, you have to really buy out that category, you know, especially if it's one that is pretty dynamic, like technology or retail or something, for example, in the healthcare space.
Now, every year there is a new social media app that everyone is raving about, be it Vine, Musical.ly, TikTok. How do you enter those arenas when they come to the scene? Do you wait a bit to see if it sticks? How do you assess if this new social platform is the right fit for you and or your clients?
Well, you know, what I'll tell you is that our clients are reasonably, I guess a better way to put it is there's two sets of clients. There's the big clients, the ones that are the household names,
right.
The Samsungs, the Dells, Microsoft, LinkedIn, Facebook.
Right.
Then we have small business clients. And you know, those are brands you maybe have never heard of. It's an online farmer's market. It's a pizza, you know, restaurant that has 5 locations in Manhattan and 5 others around the country. You know, it's a woman who is a diversity expert who helps Fortune 1000 companies get more leadership positions that are, you know, women and professionals of color. So those are clients that I would tell you are much more adaptable and open and amenable to trying a new platform. You know, starting a YouTube channel, creating content and seeing what sort of performs well. And from there, deciding upon a longer form strategy. The bigger clients, and this is probably not a surprise, are a little bit more resistant to, you know, jumping on TikTok and starting to turn out content. It doesn't mean it's a no. It just means it's a little bit of a longer play.
Right.
I show a little bit of, I do a little more research. We prove some case studies to them of maybe competitors or aligned brands that have done well on those platforms.
Right.
So I'm always game to try something new if I think it'll work. I just have to sort of factor in a little bit of a timeline for those companies that are a little bit more change and risk averse, and for good reason, right? They're much larger. They have stakeholders and investors to impress upon. So we try to give them a little bit more flexibility.
But on a personal standpoint, do you jump in right away and just to see how that platform is doing?
Yeah, like I've got a couple of accounts that like no one knows about on channels that I'm exploring.
Right.
You know, I'm also like a person who enjoys to consume content, even if I'm not creating it. So I might have an account on a platform that I'm not even posting to, just so I can kind of see what people are doing.
Right.
And just understand, like, you know, for example, on TikTok, I'm not an active poster, but on Twitter, I'll often see posts by people sharing TikToks on Twitter. So it's
right.
almost like, even if you're not using that channel for that purpose, you might take that content and share it on a channel where your followers actually are.
Right, right. What are some emerging trends and where do you see the social media industry going moving forward?
Well, I will say I don't think it's slowing down anytime soon. People love to sort of ask me about, you know, why Instagram is removing the likes, you know, if that's a sign of something to come that implies sort of a slowdown. And I often, you know, reply that no, I think, you know, Instagram and Facebook deeply understand how important it is to, you know, share content with your friends and to understand how that content is performing. You know, if Instagram wanted to remove all forms of, you know, likability and understanding of how a post is doing, they would remove comments and shares too, right?
Right.
They didn't.
Right.
So what I think is probably true from a social media industry standpoint is that people are going to start looking at new ways to measure their content. The onus is going to be on us, if you're a content creator, to prove to a brand or a third party or a sponsor that you have X amount of likes or engagement on a post, if that's not public to them. So a little bit more work for us, Edwin, but certainly something, you know, we can do pretty easily. And then I think from a future standpoint, you know, I'm excited. I think social media continues to be a way that we democratize communication. You know, we don't need to, you know, set up a press release or, you know, set up a press conference to communicate with our followers or our clients. You know, social media is still the direct line to the consumers that all businesses want and have wanted for decades. And, you know, if you use it the right way, it can really be a focus group where you ask your followers for their opinions on products that you have or products that you want to have and get feedback again for free.
I hear a lot of content creators trying to beat the algorithm or complaining about the algorithm. Is that something top of mind when you're creating content?
It's not for me. And, you know, I think that's probably just because I don't even know how I have as many followers as I do. Like, sometimes I question it. I'm like, what are you guys doing? Like, I'm not, you know, what are you guys following me for in these, like, droves of amounts? You know, something like tens of thousands of followers per channel, you know, filling up, like, my husband's always like, you could fill Madison Square Garden with your followers. And I'm like, I don't know. But the thought to me is more around, like, how grateful I am that there are so many people who have demonstrated an interest in what I have to say and learning about social media from me. I don't really think about, like, why aren't more people engaging with my posts or, right, you know, how do I double my likes? This doesn't really kind of cross my mind. I guess I've always been a little bit more of like a quality over quantity person. Maybe that's like what comes with being a little bit of an older millennial. Right. But I don't know. It seems unusual to me to be so fixated with what you could have when you have so many good things already.
I agree. As someone who hires freelancers, what do you look for in them? And are you for or against hiring and using freelancers who are overseas?
No. I mean, I'm a big fan of hiring freelance talent. I have one full-time employee and the rest of my team is all freelance. So big fan of, you know, hiring everyone from like a graphic designer to our lawyer to, you know, an assistant who helps us with like, you know, packaging. She's wrapping holiday gifts. And so big fan, definitely open to hiring people overseas. You know, for us, it's really not at all about geography. It's about sort of equal parts hunger and hard work and people who are passionate about, you know, social media and, you know, eager to learn.
How has a failure or apparent failure set you up for later success?
I talk about my layoff at Rolling Stone quite a bit. It happened almost 10 years ago, but it actually, you know, at the time, as you can imagine, was pretty traumatic. You know, I lost not only my first job, but my dream job. And I remember being like, this was not the plan, right? I was going to become the editor of Rolling Stone someday, right? I moved to New York to write for Rolling Stone. I moved here for an internship there and turned it into a job. So it really caught me off guard. And I remember at the time feeling like this was a real failure and a real, you know, sort of ego killer. And, you know, within a few months, and it was as fast as a few months, when I started to see that you know, the opportunity to make real money, have my own business, you know, have my name on the door and be making decisions that were in my best interest, not someone else's. And the burden of that too, right? Being responsible for other people's income and salary and also, you know, livelihood. That feeling kind of was a much more fulfilling one, even if it was a harder one. It was a much more fulfilling one than sort of going into someone else's office and clocking in and out metaphorically and kind of helping their business grow. So I would say that the failure of like losing my job turning into the opportunity of starting my business has to be the biggest one that I can think of in my career.
What are you doing to continue to get better to feed the beast per se. You know, it's easy to get comfortable after reaching that target we aimed at. What is still fueling your fire?
It's what I said a little bit before, you know, this idea that I have employees who are dependent upon me for mortgages and, you know, food on the table for their families. I also, you know, am a person who grew up with immigrant parents who didn't graduate high school. Actually, that's not true. My mom graduated high school. My dad did not. But the idea that I'm the first person in my family to go to college and have a successful business and make my family proud, possibly one day make my own family proud, my children. And you know, I think all of this sort of ladders up into this idea that if you kind of have this aspiration to do something that is your own, and you're able to see success year to year, and you're able to grow it into something that doesn't just fuel your own success, but fuels the success and the pride of those around you. I mean, it's so fulfilling, and it's so inspiring also to just keep going and see where you can take it.
And wrapping up, what is your biggest challenge at the moment?
Time. I don't have enough of it, Edwin. If you can give me some more time, that would be so wonderful. I feel like, you know, the biggest challenge of all, for, you know, time is like the most precious gift, right? It's this idea that, you know, we have people that we love in our lives that we don't get to spend enough time with. I talk about my parents on every interview I give because they're so inspirational to me. And then I'm like, oh my God, I have to call them. I haven't called them in 4 days. So, you know, it's a matter of finding the time, because I think it's not that we don't have the time, it's that we don't find the time.
Right.
To, you know, be in touch with the people we love, you know, do right by the people that we have in our lives, you know, reward people for a job well done, just finding that time to really focus in on people and find them, you know, give them that purpose and that kind of respect that they so deserve.
Now, this is a question that I ask every guest. What does a minority mean to you?
You know, to me, there's a lot of different ways to answer this question. In my mind, a minority has historically been somebody who is underserved or underrepresented, someone who might have to work twice, three times, five times as hard as their counterpart who, you know, is maybe equally talented or even less so. But what excites me is this idea that in 2019 or even 2020, that might not be the definition of minority anymore. You know, a minority could very much just be that we are a smaller percentage of the population who is equally represented in success, business, and other categories in which we historically have not been present. So it's exciting to me that the definition is evolving, no doubt with thanks to shows like yours and, you know, women like Lucy Sorrentini, who are our client, who help with diversity expertise in these Fortune 1000 companies, and people like my parents, who work really, really hard and disrupt the status quo and are the first in their families to, you know, move to the United States and start their own businesses. So redefining the word of the definition of minority is hopefully one that we can all collaborate on in terms of how, you know, the world perceives us.
Great answer. What last question? What is the title of the current chapter of your life?
Oh, Edwin, killing me. Maybe it's that. Edwin, you're killing me. What is the title of the chapter that I'm currently in?
Right.
I like to say that it's unwritten. You know, if I had to pick a word, it might be unwritten. I don't, you know, like to sort of do anything twice that you know, is, you know, I like to say that success is never doing the same thing twice, you know, unless it was really, really fun the first time. And so I like to kind of keep my clients and my friends on their toes in terms of what I'll do next and continue to reinvent and do things that hopefully surprise and delight my followers and my you know, clients.
Well, thank you so much. You can find Natalie on Instagram at Natalie Safat and on her website, nataliesafat.com. Everything will be on the show notes page and on the website. Anything else you'd like to add?
This was really fun, Edwin. Thanks for getting me to think about some of the tough stuff today and think about the future. It's always a pleasure, especially this time of year,
right,
when everyone is so much looking ahead at 2020 to both look ahead, but also to reflect. It's a great it's a great opportunity. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been another great episode of Minorities in Business, where we inspire the minority to become the majority. I am Edwin Serrano, and thank you so much for listening.